Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini, and this is a podcast for women over 40.
Which I always forget to say, or often forget to say.
All I want is a blooper reel of your intros. It's all I want. If I think about it every time we do this, and I think, I just want a blooper reel.
Oh my God, I'm so stupid.
You're not so stupid. We were just discussing this, that you call yourself stupid and I call myself an asshole, and we have to stop.
No, you're right. They are our worst fears about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I alternate between thinking I'm stupid and thinking I'm an asshole.
I know that I'm a little stupid.
That's good, honey.
It's not a thing I call myself. I just know I am a little bit dense.
That's okay. I feel the same way.
It's totally fine. Smart in some ways.
Okay, so we have part two of our Ask Us Anything episode.
Here it is, and we have part two.
Part two, and we have a whole lot to get through.
We do. We really do. Oh my God, we're going to have to move more quickly this time, or this one will be longer. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. You know, we'll see how it works. Okay, I'm going to ask you the first question.
Okay.
What situation brings you the most anxiety? And I'll ask the second question too. And what do you do to relieve anxiety? What helps you move through it? How do you boost your happiness?
God, what causes me the most anxiety? I wasn't prepared for this question. I'm sorry. Let me think about it.
I'll go first.
You go first.
Thinking about terrible things happening to people I love.
Wow.
Causes me a huge amount of anxiety. Thinking about things I should have done by now, I haven't done, like not exciting things like hiking the Pacific Trail, but like, you know, Picayune, like life things I haven't done.
Interesting.
That I'm too embarrassed to talk about. It's actually I'm thinking about something in particular, which is just a being an adult in the world thing to do that I have not done in a while.
I know what you're talking about. I will tell you, okay, things that cause me the biggest anxiety. Thinking about things happening to someone I love does not cause me anxiety because it used to. And now I think about it as almost like a meditative practice. Like, what if something happened to my kid? Oh, fuck. I better love my kid more every single moment that I'm with. Every time I think something like could happen to my kid, I turn that into let me love them in this moment because I can't control that.
Right.
Okay. Anxiety for me. Money. Money, money, money. I'm always anxious about money. Always. Am I going to have enough money? What's going to happen with money? Is all this money going to dry up? Are we going to lose our jobs? Money. So I have financial insecurity all the time, which is not entirely real. Like I'm not broke. We have savings. I'm not a total idiot, but the feeling of like, are we going to stop being able to generate money, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. My health worries me a lot. I have a lot of hypochondria and like, oh my God, what if I'm dying? What if I'm dying? What if I'm dying? I have that. That's a big one for me. I can, but I don't allow myself go into a total spiral about the world, mm-hmm. you know, nuclear war. Oh my God, we got to get the fuck out of this country. Oh my God, what the fuck with this trans legislation, with this anti-gay country we're starting to live in. I can get into a real like, fuck, what are we doing here? I don't, this country makes me feel very afraid. And what do you do to get rid of? I mean, I think I'm an anxious person. I mean, I'm also socially anxious. So, lying in bed or after I leave an event, always, there's never a time where I'm not like, oh God, why did I say that stupid thing? Oh, that person probably thinks I'm an idiot. I have that a lot.
I can still think about things I said 20 years ago and be like, oh man, like I can cringe as though I just said it.
Yeah, I have that. I have that just now. Like, I'll just be like, oh, fuck, did I hurt the person's feelings? I meant that as a compliment when I said that thing about their pants. You know? just feeling like just sort of wild and unhinged. I mean, I think I used to worry that my husband would leave me. I think that used to be a real anxiety for me. And I think that how I dealt with that was just by being a dick and kind of like testing him, like, oh, maybe you should leave me. Yeah.
That's so wise. Honey.
Oh, no, that's nothing's wise. Okay. So wait, how do we
deal with it? I believe I think this isn't yet another AA saying, move a muscle, change a thought. Just like the other day I was feeling anxious about some shit. I just went outside. I just took the dog outside and took a walk around the block.
Yeah, that helps. Sometimes just facing it too. Like I have a lot of anxiety, like, you know, the stupid shit that like piles up that I'm really bad at. The life's admin, you know, mm-hmm. you go and you have health insurance and you go and you get a test or you go and you get a procedure done. And somehow you have like 10 bills that are just like small bills, but you're like, well, why is this happening? You know, it's like, do I need to look into this bill? Like, should my mammogram have been free? You know, it's just like, and then I won't pay them and then they'll go into collection. I mean, not to be too embarrassing, but like, it's fucking awful. Like I just, and sometimes it's just a matter of just like reckoning with yourself and being like, okay, today's the day I face these three things that make me feel really anxious and terrible.
Yeah. I find another thing about things when I blow things off, which is something I really am inclined to do. I blow things off. And then if I just have another person helping me,
yes,
like not even helping, like holding my hand saying, see, all you got to do is this.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually not that difficult. I will build things up into my head, as being just untouchable, like impossible. And then if there's someone with you saying like, no, you just connect A to B, then I'm fine.
We, in my marriage, in my partnership, we've started to, instead of getting mad at the other person, one of the ways that we've kind of evolved as a partnership is we're now starting to see each other's areas where they need support and help and help each other. And now Alex, just whenever he sees any of these like medical bills, he just opens them and pays them because he knows that's not something that I'm going to do or can really handle, which has been a fucking lifesaver for me. But also sitting down and being like, oh, fuck, this closet is like hoarders. Can you help me figure out how to organize it? Because I'm bad at that stuff, but it makes me feel anxious that there's just like I open a drawer and I can't find anything.
Yeah.
So, yes, finding support. And that can be a friend, too. I remember when I was in New York, I had a really good friend who would like open my cabinets and be like, what the fuck's in here? You know, and people who just have different strengths than you have. And then on top of that, having some self-compassion that's not an area of strength for you. And that's okay.
Yeah. And that you can work around it. You can put yourself on manual and get through it.
Yeah. 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 There's another question here that was before this. As a freelancer, what is your advice for getting paid on time?
Yeah, that I thought you would be good to speak to that.
So, yes, I am good at speaking to that because I hate late pay. And as just discussed, I have a lot of money anxiety. So I usually make sure I know what the payment schedule is from whatever client I'm working with. Like, how, well, do you pay in 30 days? Do you, how, when can I expect this payment? And then the second that it is outside of that payment, first off, I'll ask if they can go on a shorter time frame. If it's something like we pay in 60 days, I'll say, could this be paid in 30? And a lot of times the person that you're working with, the client, will say, oh yeah, sure. That's something standard we put in a contract, but we can amend that. So that's first. And then the second thing is, the second that someone hasn't paid me, I start following up. I become a dog on a bone. And that's not rude. And you don't have to do it in a rude way. Hey, as per our contract, I just wanted to make sure this was coming this week. Or, you know, just making sure that you have my W-9 and everything's all set for getting paid next week. I don't like to chase down money, but the earlier you do it, the better.
In all things.
So yeah.
That's good advice.
And then if somebody doesn't fucking pay me on time, I will never work with that person again. I had somebody owe me a significant amount of money. I also called up my lawyer and I was like, you know what? I've asked three times. It's your turn.
Yeah.
And once you bring a lawyer in, even if you have to pay like for the hour of the lawyer's time, that usually shuts the whole situation down. And then you probably won't work with them again, because if someone's really late paying you, you probably don't want that. You don't want to deal with them anymore.
No. And that's what the only advice I could think of for this was, know who you're working for.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, checking out when they're, you know, when they pay, but also know who you're working for. Go on Glassdoor, see if they have a bad reputation for not paying people on time. And if they do, don't think you'll be any different.
Right. And the thing is, sometimes you're weighing these things out. Like if it's a project with a client that you know is going to give you, that's of high value to you, then maybe you deal with a little bit of a pain in the ass situation. You know, this is always a weighing it out. It's always a weight system, you know, like how much is the value to you versus the hassle?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Kim, for you. Well, I guess for me too.
I think this is for both of us.
I guess we both worked at Condé Nast. I realized I worked for like six magazines at Condé Nast, by the way.
That's
anyway,
crazy.
Okay. Talk more about what it was like working at Condé Nast, Kim France.
Some parts of working at Condé Nast were absolutely wonderful. In those days, it was a company that really valued creativity. And when I was hired to work on Lucky and I hired some staff, I was never forced to do focus groups. I mean, we did them later, but they were our choice. So I was never forced to listen to research about what they thought our market was. I was allowed to go on instinct about what I thought would make the best magazine. And that was amazing to have that kind of freedom. And my boss, James Truman, was incredibly supportive for the entire time he was there. I felt like he really had my back. Which is a great thing to have, a boss who has your back. Unfortunately, after he left, I didn't think anybody had my back. And that was pretty tough, because the other side of Condé Nast was, in those days, it was a very, I have no idea what it's like to work there now, but it was a tough place. Riding, I mean, you know, we've talked about it on this podcast before, riding the elevators in the Condé Nast building was like the least relaxing thing you could do. You know, people just looking you up and down. Even the cafeteria, there was always like, there was like a weird hostile vibe. I mean, it was a company that valued their titles competing against one another.
Yes.
Which was different than Hearst, where editors, like editors in chief and managing editors, would all get together and have these like group chats or like meetings. And at Condé Nast, it was every title, every man for himself.
Right.
And that, right, for someone like me was really hard. And, you know, it was also just a place of intense and incredible privilege.
Oh, can I tell you, I was always shocked in the cafeteria because you know, the lowest rung, the most junior positions there didn't pay very well. So in order to live in New York, and work one of these jobs, you were most likely parentally subsidized, right? Which meant there was a certain kind of person who could work at Condé Nast, right? It wasn't like you were getting a scholarship, you know, like you're working at Condé Nast for $30,000, $35,000 a year, which was not enough. When I worked there for that much, I used to have, I think, like $50 left a week for food and cigarettes and drinks and whatever. Like I went into severe debt. But one of the things that I remember in the cafeteria was no one knew how to spoon food onto their plates. And I was like, have you never fucking spooned your own food? I was hilarious. Are you this rich that somebody's been spooning your food this whole time?
Oh, no. Because you know what really rich people do?
Tell me.
This is how really rich people serve food.
Explain it.
They have the help come out and hold the tray of beef. And you have to very carefully spoon the tray of beef onto your plate. And then the mashed potatoes come and you've got to very carefully spoon those. And yes, I had relatives who did this, fancy relatives. And I found it just excruciating.
I would be in the line behind people at the salad bar and I'd be like, you don't know how to use these salad bar utensils. You have never been at a Pizza Hut salad bar.
But the other thing, remember how disgusting it was? Like there were hard-boiled eggs. Yes. You could take a hard-boiled egg and everybody was like, not the yolk, not the yolk. So they'd like break them open. Yes. And then squeeze out. Yes, it was disgusting.
In line, while you were in line, they were just like just mangling these eggs so they didn't have the yolk even on their plate. They wouldn't even take the whole egg and put it on their plate. There was just like it would just be like a tray of discarded yolks, like egg carcass.
It was it was really disgusting.
It was really bad. I mean, like the eating disorders on display in that cafeteria. That was.
Can I just have every time in the Chinese food stir fry?
Yes, in the stir
fry. Girls
would
be like, "Can I just have a squinch of oil?"
Yeah, no oil, no oil. And they would be like, "We can't really cook these in the wok without oil." And they'd be like, "No oil, no oil." And I was like, "Eat the fucking oil."
No, it was crazy. And then the other crazy thing about the Condé Nast cafeteria was that Cy Newhouse hated garlic.
Yes, so there was no garlic in it. So even the hummus. Oh,
the hummus is exactly what I was thinking about. The hummus and the pasta station. Like, why have a pasta station?
Oh, my God. That's right. That's why all that pasta was disgusting.
Yes. It had no garlic in it. It was crazy.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It was a cool like, it could never exist today. I've thought about this since. Like, the Condé Nast cafeteria could never exist today because of iPhones. When we were in there, it was before phones, like, because people would be taking pictures all the time. People, like, you couldn't have celebrities in the Condé Nast cafeteria anymore. You couldn't have, like, Martha Stewart, like, chowing down, you know? Just, it wouldn't happen in the same way because we just stalk everyone now because we have cameras with us at all times. But also, equally, I was thinking about how wonderful the Condé Nast library was. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that library? I forget which floor it was on, but it was just like, it was a library of every Condé Nast magazine ever put out. And like, sometimes I would just go in there like for pleasure and just pull the magazines and like look at all the old issues. And that was really incredible. And you couldn't do that now, I think also because of iPhones. I don't know, maybe you could, but.
They also had an amazing database of every photograph that was ever taken for Condé Nast. So not just, I mean, including everything that was killed.
Yes, yes.
So that big poster I had of Mia Farrow that was in my office
with the gun,
pointing the gun, holding the gun up, rather, never appeared. It was for Vogue, but it never appeared in the magazine.
Oh, wow.
And I used to love going through that database, and you could find all of the photography Diane Arbus did for Mademoiselle, which was actually kind of boring. You know, thought it would be slightly more interesting, but she was, you know, she knew her assignment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there were great things about working for a company. I mean, you know, the expense accounts were bottomless. All of that was really cool, but it came with a price. It came with a very high price.
Yes. I mean, I think that we tend to glorify the good old days, you know, all the nostalgia. And there were a lot of bad things about the good old days, you know, that there was not enough diversity in any of those magazines.
None.
Not enough racial diversity, not enough class diversity, not, you know, it was just like, these were just magazines made by rich white people for the most part. However, there was also so much budget to, like,
it's incredible what you could pay writers. And I was at the tail end of it, you know?
It was incredible what you could pay writers. And also it was, you know, if you wrote, I remember this from before, Lucky, like if you wrote for a Condé Nast publication and they killed your story, they'd be like, ah, you worked hard on it. I'll give you the folk fee.
Yeah.
You know, there was just like, there was a lot of, you know, Cy Newhouse was like a Medici, you know, yeah. He just like, he kept an entire class of creative people going.
Yeah. And valued and treated creative people like they have value.
Yeah.
I mean, your job was about strategy, sure, but it was more about creating the best creative product you could, right?
Yeah.
You didn't have to look at numbers every, well, you did as it got
I did have to look at some numbers, yeah. But I was given the freedom to create the magazine with that staff that we wanted to create. And
yeah.
that was really wonderful. But, you know, Devil Wears Prada is a documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was like that, but worse.
Glamour was horrible. I mean, I've talked about this in the past, but Glamour was just like weird, like fiefdom. And there were just like the plebes were the plebeiest plebes at Glamour. And I was a total fact checker. I was a plebe at Glamour.
At Glamour, didn't they have like a pit that was called the pit, which is where if you were the plebeiest plebe, you had to work like right in the center of the office in this pit. And then as it radiated out, there were offices for more senior people.
Yes. Yes. And Glamour was the worst because nothing in Glamour was ever true. And you were a fact checker. So that was like the worst job. But there was a thing where every month Glamour would do like one serious feature. And it was like, you know, the 9/11 widows. And if you heard whisper of that coming around and you were a fact checker, you just ducked under your desk so you wouldn't get that story because it was like usually really bad reporting. No offense to Glamour editors, but like bad reporting. But then also these impossible standards where everybody had to be attractive. So if you were doing a story about breast cancer survivors, all the breast cancer survivors had to be beautiful and then also have compelling stories. So these were like impossible, like, they were so chopped up to fit this like weird standard of like beauty and also kind of factually accurate. That was a messy hybrid of a magazine. At least Lucky was just like, this is what we're doing. And I found that very refreshing after fact, because I also fact checked at Allure. I fact checked at Cosmo, which was not Condé Nast. I fact checked at House and Garden?
House and Garden, yeah. Still exists, I think.
Does it? That was nuts. But yeah, no, you just always felt like a dirty scumbag. At least I did. Yeah.
I did. I mean, I was always checking my nails for dirt underneath. You know, I never got enough. I never felt, especially at like, you know, events where I had to see the other editors in chief, like I never felt polished enough. Sitting at fashion shows, I never felt like I had it together enough. I know I didn't.
I can't believe you had to, because even riding the elevator with Anna Wintour was just a very chilly experience. Like, there she is.
No.
Yes.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, or Grace Coddington was the best sighting to me. Every time I saw Grace Coddington.
Yeah. That was always a good sighting. I enjoyed an Andre Leon Talley sighting.
That was a good
because
sighting.
Because he and people like, you know, that Hamish Bowles, like, they're just these outsized, crazy characters who were very, very creative and who were allowed to flourish in that environment.
Right.
You know, because it was a privately held company, because there was not a board to answer to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who was the most, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just wondering, like, what was the most exciting? Like, what was the most, like, what was a moment that you had as editor-in-chief that you remember thinking, oh, shit, I can't believe I'm having this moment?
I mean, I think there were a lot of, you know, flying around places was pretty great. You know, I have to say at the beginning, sitting in first class on an airplane and not being able to stretch my legs far enough to touch the seat in front of me.
Wow. Yeah.
I was like, wow, like this is crazy. And I get to like, let's think of some places I can fly because I'm going to do this in Canada.
Did you go to like Paris for the fashion shows and Milan?
Never went to Paris because the money is really in Milan.
Okay.
And Paris, I mean, if the Italians hated Lucky, then the Parisians like wouldn't even acknowledge it.
Okay.
So I did go to Milan a fair amount. I hated Milan. Hated it. Hated going. At first, I thought it was kind of cooler than the New York shows because you don't have all like the, you know, you have some photographers taking pictures of people outside the shows, but there wasn't as much of a hubbub. There wasn't right. like the Front Row Daily and all these publications devoted to it.
Right.
And I thought it seemed a little more chill, but the city of Milan is just not a favorite of mine. It's like a cold city and the men are impolite. And mm-hmm. the food is amazing. That yeah. that I like. But I was always cold in Milan. I was always freezing. I didn't like going to fashion shows. I didn't like having to sit in the first row. I didn't like the people that put me in the company of it, with some exceptions.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I was aware, especially at the beginning, of like eyes boring a hole in the back of my head.
Yeah.
Like, what did that bitch do to get there?
Right. 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 Ew, ew. But when you were traveling, were you like, okay, I'm in Milan. I'm going to get on a train and I'm going to go to Florence.
No, because there was no time to do stuff right. like that.
Right.
You know, we always have to turn back around. That is something I thought about, though. I got to travel to lots of really cool places and do, you know, stay in beautiful hotel rooms, like by myself, not having fun.
That's the fucking thing about all of these things where you're just like, how this should be so wonderful. And yet it's not because of the context.
Yeah. I mean, I remember thinking when I was hired to do Lucky, they hired me at first for 6 months just to come up with test pages. Mm-hmm. And then if that went well, we would get permission to do a test issue. And I remember having a lot of feelings around that time, like, wow, how will my life change? And it was always like, I'll have a driver and I'll have a clothing allowance. And it wasn't also like, I'll be responsible for the bottom line when they're talking about newsstand sales. And, you know, I will have three publishers, none of whom like me.
Right.
And all of whom will do what they can to get me fired.
Right. And so, and there's no amount of dresses in the land that can make that better. That's
no.
the fucking thing. That's the fucking thing. It's like, whenever I've had a lot of money and I've been like, you know what? I'm just going to buy that $600 pair of jeans or whatever the fuck it is, right?
Yeah.
And you're just like, you're in like a consumptive moment because you're rewarding yourself. But you're rewarding yourself. It doesn't help. But you still feel sick inside.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, I do, you know, occasionally I'll miss it. You know, like I saw this like the perfect caftan. And it was almost $900. Like when I was at Lucky, I might have thought twice about buying a caftan for $900, but I was doing it.
Right. But you would have also gotten, you also could have gotten that for free.
For cheaper, for sure.
For a lot cheaper. Right. And also, yeah. I mean, you had a clothing allowance, didn't you?
I had a clothing allowance. It was a magical thing.
That's
it's like, it's so funny. It's comical to me that I had like some of the things I had and the way my life felt like in those days, and the fact that I was always being trailed by an assistant, you know, like it was just a different way of being. It was a different way of being, and I in some ways I think that Condé Nast was both the best and the worst thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least you will not be your whole life wondering what if I had had that kind of a thing. What if?
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah. And that's huge for me.
Misery is a little strong, but your unhappiness, let's say, in that job or discomfort in that job was so instructive for me because I knew you pretty well, even though that was probably inappropriate how well I knew you and understood you. But watching you not being satisfied in that job made me not want a job like that. It was very instructive to watch because I was like, wait, we're similar. I wouldn't be happy in this. And it was a real moment for me because I took a turn into digital at that time because I was like, wait. I mean, also that it was all collapsing. So it wouldn't have, and maybe I wouldn't have gotten higher, but I was pretty good at what I did. And I saw you and I was like, oh, I don't want, that's not a dream I want.
Yeah. And I've seen, you know, I had a friend who got a job like mine and she loved it. She loved it. She took advantage of everything. She like climbed all the way up the ladder. Yeah. She, you know, threw parties. She did all the shit that I just wasn't into. So, you know, it works for some people. You know, I think she also became a pretty horrible person. So there's that.
Well, there's that, right? Exactly. Exactly. Would you like a soul? I don't know. Or would you? It's fine.
No, somebody wrote to me, the girls who do Go Fug Yourself, that hilarious blog, wrote to me after I got fired, you know, because we had become friendly. And I was like, you know, it's just, you know, it feels okay. I just, you know, you got to check your soul at the door when you go into that place. So I'm happy to have mine back.
Totally. Totally.
And I did feel that way for all, you know, and I say that, you know, also acknowledging that there were many good things about it.
Yeah. I mean,
or
obviously.
Several, or a few.
There were a few. And it was an interesting time of your life. You're going to look back on that, I think, as like, whoa, that was an interesting time of my life.
Take a quick break for some ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And we're back. I'm going to come back to a couple of these questions. I'm going to skip ahead so we can do, you know, so we can have a lot of different topics in this. Been talking with friends about who am I now? Feels like 2019 us went poof and not sure how to put together a 2022 and beyond us that we like. Thoughts on where to begin?
That's a really hard one.
I think you begin where you are. What do you like now? Who do you want to see? Who do you like? What are you interested in? I think the worst thing any of us can do is think that we're going to be the same people as we were 2 years ago and try to live like a contrived life, you know, that resembles what we were doing before, because that might not be organic to us. It might be, but I think you just sort of, I've been talking to my kid a lot about this because my kid's like, I'm so boring now. I don't like anything. And I was like, no, it's not that you don't like anything. You don't know what you like right now because we've been inside for 2 years. So I think.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I remember a time when I was going through a tough time and I just felt like nothing excites me. Nothing has texture. And somebody asked me, like, what do you look forward to? And I was like, seeing my nephews.
Yeah.
And that really felt like it, you know, but also like if that's your one thing and it seems tiny and pathetic to you, it doesn't matter. It's like still a thing that you can reach out with.
Right. I mean, like I was saying before, it's like you look, or I wasn't saying this before, but I was thinking it. You look for like what glows, you know, and it's like, okay, and that'll take you down the path to sort of rebuilding what it is that you like again. And like, that's the great thing. We don't have to keep liking the same shit. We can change and evolve and be like, now I'm a person who goes to baseball games or, you know.
Yeah. Like, you know, realizing like that can be a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like this may seem like nothing, but actually that can be a thing and follow that thread.
I am a person who now has dinner once a month with a group of women who are kind of strangers to me. I would never think of myself as a person who is like part of like a dinner club. But like, I craved in-person interaction with people, with women my age, and I still don't know that many women in LA. So, you know, I think that it's just like also both not staying attached to who you used to be, and also, I don't know where the second part of this is, but basically just being kind of open and being like, well, maybe this.
Yeah. I mean, when I feel uninspired that way, I think about my mom, because my mom has done this amazing job since before my stepfather died, but especially after, of building a life, you know, in a city where she wasn't born, and finding friends.
Yeah.
And I think it's because she's just willing to be open to it and unafraid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, totally. And also consistent, I think. She has like a lot of discipline with it, right?
Yeah. 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 For
which,
sure.
Okay. So this leads us to our next question, which is, I'm just going to read it. And then read the next one. This may be a boring one, but I'm always interested in knowing what a typical day, if there is such a thing, looks like for freelancers and independent workers, creatives. How different or similar are your days now compared to pre-pandemic or in this next stage we seem to be entering?
I mean, my days are very different than they were for like the thick of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was like, I feel like I was doing Zoom calls constantly with friends and also, you know, for work things, but mostly to stay in contact with people. I was alone for the first half of COVID, so that was really different. I would say like my days are, I go through periods, you know, where when I first started the blog, I only wanted to write at night.
Yeah.
And I was staying up very, very late and then sleeping very, very late. And now I find I get up early, and I've realized recently, like whatever I'm going to get done, I get done in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then whatever gets done after the morning is a bonus. But, you know, I even like the most successful writer I know says like 3 hours of writing a day and I'm out.
Yeah. My schedule is largely dictated by the Los Angeles public school schedule. So I wake up at 6:30, look at my phone for a while or do yoga. I have an hour to myself from 6 to 7 in the morning. Which sometimes is a very personally nurturing hour, and is more often than that a time where I'm just fucking around and looking at reading newsletters and, you know, whatever, dicking around
on
my phone.
But I think that that's important, the like fucking around in the morning.
Yeah, it's, you know, whatever. I'd rather be doing, I like to do about 20 minutes of yoga in the morning. That's what I like to do, but doesn't happen. Anyway, so then I have another hour after that where I make lunch, wake my child up, you know, get my kid out the door. Now it's 8:00, 8:30 by the time I get home from drop off. And then I shower if I'm going to shower that day, which just doesn't always happen when I'm really feeling in a big, thick schedule. And then I figure out the blocks of my day. And that doesn't mean I'm going to follow those blocks, but like what projects need me urgently? Like, do I have to answer these 3 emails? Because I'm currently juggling 5 projects, and that will stop soon. I'll go down to 2, then I'll go down to 3, then I'll go down to 2, then I'll go down to 1, and then, you know, we'll rebuild. But so I have a block of time where I'm like, now I'm going to answer emails and sort out anything that's on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, because I'm working on this big, you know, needs sort of deeper thinking project, then I sort of have the rest of the day, whatever hours those are, to do deep thinking work. So then I'm just going to start writing, because there's the first hour of writing when you can't get shit done, where your brain's just like all over the place. And then after an hour, I kind of can settle into it. And I've been doing a new thing where if it's not working, I've been trying to just stop just staring at it, because I find that the hours when it's not working and you're just trying to make it work and you're muscling through are so demoralizing that they hurt other productive hours.
I agree with that. I totally agree with that. I believe that, and I also believe that going away from something and then coming back to it can be creatively really satisfying and productive.
100%.
It's like letting the pan soak.
Yes. Yes. Now, you know, there's all different stages to whatever creative practice you're in. Like, you know, there's just getting the words down, which, you know, some people are better at or not, or getting the project down, and there's refining and whatever. But then the other thing is I have like in my back pocket a list of tasks that I hate doing, which we've talked about, you know, like filing expenses, invoicing, all of that shit that I hate doing. And when I get stuck in writing, I switch to something like that.
Yep. Yep.
So then at least I feel like, okay, I did one thing that I hate doing today. So even if the writing was terrible, I put out the fires that had to be put out. I did one thing that I hated and I got a little bit of writing done.
Mm-hmm. I think that's good. I'm very impressed.
Well,
I'm just like, okay, whatever today brings.
You're just not under the amount, like you just.
No, I don't have as many projects going as you.
You're not under the same pressure. And it's because you have one project that's consistent that is sustaining financially.
Yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that's my day. People do days much better than that. But the blocks really do, I think, help thinking about, I'm going to be working in this capacity with my brain for these hours and this capacity for these hours.
Yep. Okay. I'm going to ask this question.
Okay.
And then I will answer it. What expectations have you had to let go of because they weren't met or never happened? How did you come to accept this? Has aging played a role, good or bad, in your acceptance? I mean, for me, the big thing I've accepted is not having kids.
Right.
And I would say that getting older has absolutely helped me accept that. Because, you know, for literal reasons, because I stopped longing for a thing that would not make sense in my life at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also, like, you know, this is kind of a personal thing to talk about on the podcast, but what the fuck? You know, when Paul and I got together, he, as I've talked to you about, mm-hmm. said, if a kid is something you really want, we can make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to take a month and think about it. And I didn't need a month to know that at 57 years old, I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
You know, even though I know that people do, you know, I feel like getting older has helped me accept not having children too, because I've watched the walk that my friends have walked with their children,
mm-hmm.
and how many challenges they've had. And frankly, I think I know a couple people who, if they had to do it over again, wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, adore their children though they do, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And the true, you know, when I was younger, I would think about like, oh, that moment when my baby was born and then breastfeeding my baby and all these beautiful, you know, and I'll be unselfish in a way that you just are never unselfish when you don't have children and you're self-involved when you don't have children. And then I realized like, no, I know some pretty fucking selfish and self-involved people who are parents.
Totally. Totally.
And it doesn't like, I do think I missed out on like one of the big things of life. I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that everybody seems to do didn't happen for me. But, you know, I look around and I see other women who didn't do it. And I'm pretty unshy about asking them why.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of people are like me. Like, it was a combination of choice and circumstance and it just didn't work. And, yeah, I mean, I getting older definitely helped with that, for sure.
I think that for me, I think that what I've had to accept is that I will never be wealthy. I mean, it could still happen, but I've accepted it not happening because the cost was not worth it to me. I could have mm-hmm. kept going as a big jobs person. I could have kept going as a digital executive. And I just, that avenue toward wealth and financial security was not worth it. I missed too much. I was missing all of the parenting. I was missing, you know, if you're working till 7 o'clock at night, you can't be there for school pickup. You don't hear about the middle school gossip. And I just made a very active choice when my kid was 8. So, you know, almost 4 years ago now, like, this is going to go by too fast, and I have to make a decision now. There's a crossroads, and I have to pick the path. And the path for me was, okay, you know, we'll be comfortable, but we won't have a ton of money because I'm unwilling to make it, and my husband doesn't care about it. And that could have ruined my marriage. That could have all kinds of things. And I just instead was just like, all right, we can do with less. It's fine.
Yeah. You know, my mom had a boyfriend once who was a business journalist, and he was interviewing some rich Texan who said, being rich is easy. You just have to think about money all the time. And who wants to do that? I mean, the people who want to do it want to do it, but.
And bullshit all. I mean, to me, it was just like, what is this, how I want to spend my life, filling my brain up with this bullshit, like this Machiavellian, like trying to beat all these other executives. Like, I was good at that. I was very strategic. I loved winning. But it was like at the cost of everything. I didn't have close personal relationships. I wasn't close to my husband. But mostly I wasn't a present parent. I was just outsourcing all that shit. And I'm so grateful. Whatever. Who the fuck cares? So I shop at Target. Who cares? Okay. Kim, I'd love to hear you speak more about your time at Sassy. Was it as fun as it seemed? What's your favorite memory from that time? Was Sassy as fun as it seemed?
It was often very fun. It was often super fun. I mean, we were all the writers and editors were crammed into what was essentially McCall's Magazine's private dining room in its previous life. And then the entire fashion department was in the room right next to us, which was like the room that leads to the dining room. And we were all, you know, the owner of the company was cheap as can be. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to sweat how we were going to afford going on trips. I remember someone once suggesting maybe we stay with readers. It was that desperate. If we wanted to get our phone messages, this was before voicemail, we had to buy answering machines. So we all bought our own answering machines, and we had these crappy little cubicles. But so that part was hard. Like, you know, none of us made anything.
Right.
And, but it was also hard. It was hard because of that, but it was super, super fun. Everybody was really funny. The fact that we were crammed in together in these tight quarters just made it, there was like an ongoing, like, you know, buzz of like hilarity at most times. And, you know, cool people came by, like, you know, Spike Jonze was our buddy.
Right.
Spike Jonze was 19 when I met him.
Right.
And, you know, just a little goof.
Right.
And, you know, we'd hang out with him whenever we were in LA. And then all of a sudden he's directing music videos. And, you know, so there were cool people came in and out of the offices, you know, Aaron Smith, who was in one of the Riot Girl bands, Bratmobile was an intern, and, you know, the Bikini Kill girls came up, and all of that was super cool. You know, I have one favorite memory, that I'm not going to do a very good job of describing, where a bunch of us gone to the Knitting Factory for a show. And this was when the Knitting Factory was still in Houston Street. Mm-hmm. And the ceiling, you know, in what was for sure a fire hazard, was all like sweater material. Mm-hmm. And so we were like, Christina and Andrea and Ale and some other people were like, okay, we're staring at this Knitting Factory ceiling. We're like, okay, would you rather have to wear a Knitting Factory ceiling swimsuit or fuck somebody with a Knitting Factory ceiling condom? And we just went on like this for like the whole, you know, for however long. And it was just hilarious. And everybody was being hilarious in exactly the way that they were funny at Sassy.
Did you know at the time how important it was? Did you have a sense at the time?
I remember someone telling me that they had heard that an editor at Mother Jones was saving her Sassies because she knew by the time she had a daughter, Sassy wouldn't be around anymore.
So you didn't. So you thought that it was going to be a failure, or?
Well, no, just that, you know, Sassy was this like rare and great thing and too good to last, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which it was. It didn't, you know, after being boycotted, they never got back the advertisers. So even though they had a very high readership. Mm-hmm. But no, to answer your question, I didn't know that I would still to this day be meeting adult women whose lives were changed by Sassy.
Totally.
I couldn't have had any idea. Like so many people have said to me, that magazine changed my life. And, you know, made them want to come to New York, made them want to work in publishing. You know, when people used to tell Christina Kelly that they went into publishing because of her, she would always say, I'm sorry.
I totally feel that. I feel that entirely.
But it was fun and it was cool. And, you know, but at the same time, when I was there, I was very worried about getting pigeonholed as a teen journalist. So I did, you know, I did a fair amount of freelancing for other publications at the time. And I wish if I had it to do over, I would have just like more completely submerged myself in Sassy and not worried about all of that.
Yeah, there is a real thing, I think, looking back, of just enjoying where you are and not thinking of the next thing. And I did not. That's a regret for me. Of just not enjoying.
Yeah, but who does that in their 20s?
I know, but, you know, it's just, I wish that I could have. Nobody does it, but I wish that I could have. That's the advice that I give people now is like, slow down.
Yeah.
Slow your roll a little bit. You're okay. The job that you can get next is going to be there next year. Enjoy this job, you know?
Yeah.
Because even when we have something good, we can't enjoy it. And that's the thing that damns us. The other part of this is, are there any female celebrities or women in the public eye whose lives, jobs, style you are a little obsessed with? In other words, your biggest celebrity girl woman crush?
Well, for sure, Pamela Adlon, but we've talked about that endlessly. There's the woman who was the lead singer. This is very obscure, a little obscure. The lead singer of a band called Elastica that was popular in the 90s and probably had one big hit, but a lot of good songs. This woman, Justine Fritchman, she was just super cool. I met her at Lollapalooza back then and just thought she was like an impossibly cool rock star. And she was dating Damon Albarn from Blur. And she just seemed so cool and British. She had a terrible heroin problem, which she came through, and she went to the Naropa Institute and like became a painter and a Buddhist, and like just lives this quiet life and is married and had this rock star life and now just lives quietly as an artist.
I mean, that's a dream for me too. Mine are people who have come to a place in their life at our age or where they have their relationship with ambition, like we talked about, in check, where they're living life, it seems to be on their own terms. I mean, mine is not, I have two. Mine is Deborah Levy, who the author, who I just think her work is so beautiful and also just so powerful and don't give a fuck. I mean, she doesn't even call it memoir, what she's writing, and living up autobiography. And my second one is not a woman, it's John Waters. John Waters seems like he is still having fun.
Yeah.
He seems like he's still active and engaged. You see interviews with him. He's like making all sorts of current references. He's still in it, but not in a way that feels like he's damaged by it, you know?
Yep. No, he seems to control it.
Yeah. And that's what I aspire to. That's what I crush on now, you know, is like, oh, this feels like not performative. You feel like you can really be an authentic version of yourself. You're still getting to do cool work. You still have some relevance, but not relevance that you're chasing, which, god damn, that I do not want to be any time for the rest of my life chasing shit.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Those are my celebrity crushes. Okay. All right. Here's one more question before we stop today. If you could go back to a previous version of you, what advice would you tell her? And at what age self would you give said advice?
What age? That's the part that I'm curious about.
I know.
Okay, let's say I would have told myself in my 20s, I would have just been like, you're smarter than you think you are. You're prettier than you think you are. And it doesn't have to be this hard.
Oh, that's good. It doesn't have to be this hard. It's fantastic. Mine would be in my 30s. Slow the fuck down. It's going to work out unless you die. And that's another way of it working out.
True.
That's it. Definitely slow the fuck down, man.
Yeah.
Enjoy the ride. All right. Well, we did it. I think we're going to have to do a third of these. That's the thing.
Too.
We still have more questions. Thanks so much, everybody, for sending these in. And thanks for listening to Everything Is Fine. We are your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it across the platforms. If you want to support the production of the show, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. We do live monthly events there. And we also do blogs, but we have not been doing that lately, but we will be soon. We have a private Facebook group on Facebook. We are on Instagram at EIF Podcast. We have Twitter. You can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com. You can find me at tinyletter.com/Jennifer Romolini. You can email us at everythingisfinethepodcast@gmail.com. Our show is edited by Natalie Rivera, who is great and takes out all of the gross things. And I think that's it for this week.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.